Thank you for downloading our historical podcast. Once again, your hosts are myself, Matt Nelson, and Wayne Bridgman.
Yes, hello. So Matt, what are we going to talk about in today's podcast? No, don't tell me, let me guess.
Guess away.
Will it be about nefarious and or criminal derring do at some point in the past? Would that be risible?
Well, being a podcast about history, it's going to be, isn't it?
Wonderful.
Well, Wayne, I want you and the listeners to use your imagination and picture this. Let me transport you away from this warm studio, Wayne, and into a dark, foggy night.
Oh, no.
You're driving home on an empty motorway.
Yeah.
In your average, dull, and exciting car.
Yeah. Well, actually, it's a BMW 5 Series Sport, Matt, and that is actually the top car in its category for the price. Although I did actually buy an approved used, there's a few miles under the hood.
Well, there isn't there on all of us, mate.
There is, but I'm a canny consumer, and I don't want to suffer paying for empty miles, Matt.
Well, you're right, actually, and you picked up on a subject close to my heart. You're basically submitting to a forecourt tax when you buy new. I mean, modern cars are very reliable, the engines often require less servicing, and the overall economy...
Hang on. You digress, though. You were saying, foggy.
Ah, okay. It's a rainy night, and the thud of the rain pounds on the roof of the car as you drive. You're sat in the motor looking out the window. Maybe you're spooked as you drive along a long stretch of road with no street lighting.
God.
The hairs on the back of your neck, Wayne, are beginning to stand on end.
Yeah.
You sense you're being followed.
I am.
Something is upon you.
Matt, look, you're creeping me out, man. I warn you now, I may have nightmares about this tonight if you keep going this route. Maybe you should steer away from this. No pun intended.
Suddenly, a motorcyclist is seen in your rearview mirror.
Jesus.
Yeah, and he's speeding up on you quickly.
Good God. I hope it's not the police. What speed was I doing in this hypothetical situation?
I'm not too sure, Wayne. But now he drives up beside you and makes you pull over by waving his shaft of a menacing weapon at you through the window.
Ooh.
So fearing that he might shoot off in your face, leaving it covered in bullets, you hastily pull over.
For the second time this week.
In your wing mirror, you see he dismounts his bike, strides over to your quaking, pathetic form, now cacking itself behind the wheel of the car.
Actually, excuse me, I think for the benefit of our listeners, I think you'll find I'd actually be strong and erect in such a situation, and not coyed like a carp.
Carp's very good.
An ornamental, sort of spotty, pretty fish.
Very good. As you look at the man silhouetted in the light of the crescent moon, you can't make out his features. He wears a mask or a scarf, Wayne, around his face. Only the eyes. Oh, those eyes. Bloodshot and piercing right through you to your very soul. You feel like a hare caught in a trap.
Or a cock. You're transfixed by the gaze of a fox.
Yes, right.
A cockerel, I mean.
Yeah. Like he's looking at you like you're a piece of meat. The rest of the man is in shadow. You can see only the distinctive tri-corner hat on his head.
But Matt, I'm a bit upset about this.
What?
Well, it's a terrible message for the kids to wear a fabric hat, or indeed suggest that it's a safe alternative for a British standard hallmarked motorcycle helmet.
Yeah, sorry kids, it's a good point. Okay, but it is a hypothetical situation.
Yes, of course. Sorry.
So, okay. Let's imagine it's one of those old-fashioned bike helmets. You know, the open face?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, back into the drama. He bellows, "Stand and deliver your money or your life."
Is he a failed drama student, this guy?
Yes, Wayne, I am.
What?
I mean, he is. Yeah. He is.
Yeah. Yes,
sir. Whilst he says this, he points his long, menacing, loaded weapon just inches from your agape mouth. You know he is willing to unload it upon you.
Well, I'd probably swallow nervously at that point.
Yes, indeed, Wayne, I'd imagine you would. But what would you be thinking as the victim?
Well, I guess a few things would enter my head, Matt, actually. Firstly, I'd be thankful for wearing brown trousers.
Makes sense.
Second, I'll be thankful it's the modern world. So now, all I'd be carrying is just plastic. So hand over the wallet, cancel the card once you've made off. You know, no problem for me.
Curse your rapier wit and logical mind, Wayne. But now, I transport you to the 1800s.
Wow.
And you're not in a car. You're in a horse-drawn carriage. Banks don't exist, let alone bank machines.
Yeah.
In fact, all your wealth is carried in little sacks upon your person.
What, you've got, like, family jewels are in there.
And the person is no other than the infamous, blood-curdling, renowned highwayman, Dick Turpin. Actually, Wayne, have you ever come across Dick on a dark night?
Well, a long time ago. I was very young, a sort of a impressionable, just wanted to please. I didn't really know what I wanted.
What, I was talking about Hyman. Anyway, your wealth base is on your person, it's there to be taken, as is your life.
You carry it with you, don't you? All the wealth's there, you know.
Yeah. And there's nothing you can do about it, right? This guy's holding a gun to your head.
Mm.
And that is what this podcast is about. The Scourge of the English Highwayman.
That's right. Today's podcast is about the menace that is the English highwayman. There are others, but we're going to focus on the English ones.
Mm-hmm.
And we're also going to delve deeper and develop arguments real historians have tried and failed to ask on these complex criminal minds.
Yeah. We're literally going to uncover for you answers to questions that people have never even dared to ask about highwaymen.
Yeah. So an example might be, so who were the highwaymen? Other dangerous lines of inquiry might lead us to ask, Matt,
where were they? And what were they doing?
It's groundbreaking. So were they just robbers? Or was there honour in their actions?
And were they really gentlemen, as Hollywood and such often portrays them?
Hold the front page.
Mm-hmm.
And how did their criminal actions inspire the creation of professional law enforcement?
Evening all. And what was all that cock-waving and acting it up at the place of execution, the Tyburn Tree in London?
Yes, the Tyburn is actually a place in London where the condemned highwaymen's sentences of death were carried out on the gallows.
Yeah. Yep, the place where they got hanged. And in some more serious cases, a fate worse than hanging. Now, a lot of men were left hanging stiff and blowing in the wind there.
Doing a Michael Hutchins. Wayne? Oh, no, that was a door handle.
Wayne, get your facts right. Jeez. It was not a door handle. It was a wardrobe.
A wardrobe, that's right.
So this podcast, concentrate, Wayne. Concentrate, I'm not sure we should keep that one in, but this podcast looks to examine the highwaymen, specifically in England, just after the end of the English Civil War, and, secondly, after the restoration of the monarchy of Charles II.
Yes, we'll look at some of these highwaymen in detail, and there were literally hundreds of them to choose from. We've picked a few that we'll think you'll find interesting from a few of the different eras of highwaymen.
Yeah, and if we actually go back to the Middle Ages, one of the very first highwaymen was Robin Hood.
Robin Hood, one we all know, one we've all heard of. We're going to delve into some of the bravery shown by them, amazingly, these criminals. And also some of the bravery shown by those they were committing crimes against.
Yes, bravery on both parts. And though we will be focusing only on highwaymen in England on this podcast, it's worth mentioning that highwaymen roamed most places. The highwaymen of the 18th and 19th centuries in the Kingdom of Hungary, for example, were known as Bettiers.
Mm.
Until the 1830s, they were mainly simply regarded as criminals.
That's what they were.
Yeah.
So,
but an increasing public appreciation of what they were doing.
Like the songs and the ballads, that sort of thing, folklore.
Yeah, stories, basically, romanticised them, Wayne.
Yeah.
And, you know, they became myth-like creatures. Just like the highwaymen in England.
Yeah, creatures or just men?
Just men.
Okay, and in Ireland, in the 17th century, through early 19th century Ireland, acts of robbery were often part of a tradition of popular resistance. Also, Matt,
mm-hmm.
Highwaymen were reported as far as India. So what does this tell us?
Well, it tells us, Wayne, where there's a road, there's a way for banditry, that is. And when people are travelling down a road slowly and with no obvious means of protection and carrying their money and possessions with them, robbers with various motivations will want to pounce on them as they presented easy prey. The highwaymen could stalk them on their journey and await the best time to strike.
Yes, they've exposed themselves during this time to these aggressive men.
Fair enough.
And the journeys were long for the travellers too, Matt.
Mm-hmm.
A trip from, well, now, a trip from Manchester to London, say.
Yeah, 3 hours on the train.
Yeah,
fast
well,
train.
Well, I know you don't like to use public transport.
That's correct. I hate
people,
it. I hate it.
By car, you'd be right, about 3 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
But in those days...
How long?
9 days by coach.
9 days on a coach to get from Manchester to London.
Rickety old coach, terrible suspension, roads aren't that great, obviously,
and
not the most speedy form of transport, clearly.
Yeah, yeah. And it seems in England, more than anywhere else, the highwayman has become well known, and the folklore full of their exploits exists more here than anywhere else.
Yeah, and these people are loved by many proportions, actually, Matt, of the English population, and they represent a sort of anti-hero, anti-establishment type persona, don't they?
Yeah,
that's been associated with their exploits and memory generally. So, Matt, let's start by looking into what highwaymen are and from whence they came.
Well, highwaymen, as we might picture them, tri-corner hat, dark cloak, mask over their faces, roamed England as a whole from the Elizabethan period to the 19th century.
How long was that?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, a highwayman was a thief, a brigand, who preyed on travellers. And this type of outlaw usually travelled and robbed by horse, as compared to the other fiend on the highways of England called a footpad.
That's basically a robber who still robbed,
mm-hmm.
but didn't have a horse, so he used...
A pad. Maybe he liked to take notes.
Now, it's worth mentioning, Matt, that mounted robbers were widely considered to be socially superior. Two footpads.
Yeah. Well, after all, it was not just anyone that could afford to buy a horse.
They were expensive.
Yeah. Maintaining it and looking after one was not cheap either. And you had to have something about you to rob someone on a horse. And a footpad could just be somebody who was ballsy enough to be a robber.
Yeah. The word highwayman is actually a nickname for the robbers. And it was first known to be used in the year 1617.
Mm-hmm.
And other euphemisms included Knights of the Road... Mm-hmm. And gentlemen of the road.
Very nice, very nice. I can see a theme about on the road.
Yeah, they're generally on the road. In the 19th century, in the American West, highwaymen were known as road agents.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same time period in Australia, they were known as bush rangers.
Ah.
Of course, we still have those today.
Yes, absolutely.
It means a bit different. Now, some robbed individually, but others worked in pairs or in small gangs.
Mm-hmm.
They often attacked coaches and then later, of course, the stage coaches. And they were... Yeah, they're slow moving, they have those long journeys we were talking about earlier. And we're very vulnerable in that protection.
They're like the manatee of the highways.
Yeah.
And manatee being a large marine, useless sort of sea life
like
creature.
A fat seal.
Yeah. Totally easy prey for most sea life.
Okay. It's a good analogy.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
It was not just individuals, though, Matt,
who
risked robbery. Sometimes the post was at risk too. And often the Royal Mail was a target for highwaymen, or at least that's the excuses they use for the delays.
Yeah. Well, but be warned, you might risk it all for a robbery, and all you get is a poxy love letter from some effeminate.
Yeah, and the penalty for robbing the King's Mail Service, often away with the monarchy, was always death.
Hmm.
But, Matt, I, like I'm sure many of our listeners, have an image of the highwayman as a gentleman robber. Where did that come from?
Well, to understand more about the genesis of this, let's look at the first well-known upper class of highwaymen. And for this, we must look at the events of the English Civil War. This was the war between the English Parliament.
Yeah, now the whys and wherefores of this war are not for this podcast. They will be a subject for a later podcast.
Maybe.
But what is important is that the Royalists...
They were on the side of Charles I...
The Royalists, Charles I, yeah, thanks for that, Matt.
Thank you. Just for the less observant listeners.
Yeah, were from a noble class or the establishment.
Yes, and they had done well with the king's rule and wanted to protect the tradition, and in part felt that to fight a king was to make an affront to God.
Because being a king, according to the king, was a divine right, of course.
Like the divine right of a woman.
God chose them in the first place. So to fight a king was to call into question God's decision-making abilities.
Mm-hmm.
Not a good idea, if you're a royalist, anyway. So the parliamentarians wanted more power on decisions running the country, taking away key powers from the king. They were sort of the new money, in many ways, in inverted commas. A businessman, some existing nobles, you know, were dissatisfied with the king's way of working. The more visionary types, and wanted more reform than perhaps the establishment did.
Yes. And so the gentleman highwayman has its origins in the English Civil Wars. When Charles I was defeated, many royalist officers were ruined, their estates confiscated, and they were left without resources. These cavaliers, the nickname for the royalists set by the parliamentarians, set the pattern for the gentleman robber. In the 1640s, many of these royalists were fast-living freebooters and mavericks who supported the king and went all in to fight for his cause in the English Civil War, and hated with a passion the yeoman farmers, merchants and parliamentarians that were pulling apart the system of order that had lasted 500 years.
Also, if you wanted to have a bit of a party in this era, you wanted to be with the royalists. Not least because the parliamentarian side contained many a Puritan killjoy type, a bit like the Amish, who would want to curb the excess nature of these party animal royalists.
So you had to fight for your right to party.
If you were a noble, yes.
Yes, yeah. Also, the less idealistic and more cynical existing highwaymen, looking at the two sides shaping it up for the Civil War, fought for the king. And they knew that the dead and dull hand of Puritanism would cut down the number of rich in society, and in turn, the rich well-to-dos taking the trips on the highways would reduce. Also, these rich folk like to have a bit of a party on the way, and binge drinking was not uncommon on a long coach journey.
Or anywhere in the UK, for that matter.
Very true.
And remember, the highwayman would wait for the right time to strike, and often drunk non-Puritans provided pretty easy victims.
Yes, sober victims were a lot harder to deal with than the intoxicated ones.
Yes.
So many an ex-highwayman fought and died on the fields of Naseby, Master Moor and Edge Hill to keep things as they were.
But in short, the king lost after a bloody and terrible civil war and eventually was hung, of course, in 1649. Again, not really going to go into that here. And those that supported him found themselves being stripped...
Ooh, matron!
Thank you. ...of their pre-war possessions and status by the new powers in Westminster. So they had all their estates taken away from them, their lands, castles, you name it.
And there was not the same amnesty here that was, for example, at the end of the American Civil War with Abraham Lincoln's famous Bind Our Wounds, which basically asked Americans to unite and forgive this defeated South, which allowed them to recover. Here, no amnesty such as this existed, and the Royalists suffered hugely after the war.
Well, it was a very spiteful war, wasn't it? You know, saying brother on brother,
yes.
Father against son.
Yes, yes.
Dog against cat.
Yes.
So without their wealth and position prior to the war, some, not all, took what they had, a horse, skills of battle.
Yes.
And did what they could to survive.
Yeah.
There was no source of income now. You know, their lands had gone.
Bear Grylls. Yes.
Yeah, that's it. Very similar, actually, to what he's got. Yeah, horse,
well,
battle,
just survival.
Why not say Bear Grylls?
But
they were men of conviction.
Very sorry.
Not common criminals, Matt.
Yes.
And they enjoyed metering out their highway justice on only those who opposed them in the war.
So, one such man was Captain Zachary Howard, who was a real zealot of the royal cause. He was deprived of his estates after the war and forced to take to the road. His rule? He only robbed those who were supporters of the Parliament side. In fact, he carried a personal vendetta against all those of the new regime and thus picked his victims with great care and choosing.
It is said of Howard, Matt, and I quote, "When he resolved on this course of life, the incredible John Hind and some others of his contemporary..."
Professor Morgan, wake up.
"In swearing he would be revenged as far as lay in his power on all persons who were against the interest of his royal master."
Now take your medicine.
Ah, get away from me! Accordingly, we're told that he attacked all whom he met that he knew to be of that party, the parliamentarian side. You know, it appears too that by the following accounts, he succeeded in hunting out those people using like a network of spies located along the various highways and those sort of highway taverns as well, along all those roads surrounding London.
And it obviously worked well for him because the first whom he assaulted on the road was the Earl of Essex. Now, this guy had been General-in-Chief of all Parliament's forces during the Civil War. His lordship was riding over Bagshot Heath with five or six of his retinue.
His retinue. Yeah, and retinue, Matt, for your benefit, it's like a word for, it's like it's bodyguard, hangers-on, colleagues, that sort of thing.
Nevertheless, Zachary rode boldly up to the coach door, commanded the driver to stand and, by God, deliver.
Oh, wow.
Adding that if he did not comply to his demand without words, neither he nor any of his servants would survive the day.
God. So, Lord Essex, you know, he's used to warfare and bloodshed, this guy, so you'd think it'd be hard to ruffle his feathers.
Yeah, yeah. So, presumably he was stout and strong.
Yeah, well, you'd have thought so, but according to the account, he was pretty terrified by all this.
Oh.
Brown's present. You know, he outnumbered Brown.
I'd imagine Brown was present that day.
Yeah, Brown was present.
Probably not just in Lord Essex breeches.
Yeah. And he was outnumbered, though, Brown, 7-1 by this guy and his retinue. So it turns out that this Earl duly shelled out. Apparently, he lost £1,200.
Oh, that must be
a lot of money, though. That had all been squeezed out of his forfeit estates, church lands, taxes. A veritable jackpot for this guy.
Mm.
And so he made a big hit here on a man who was central to the Parliament side. Everyone's happy.
Cash back. Ahem. Okay, right. So Zachary was so well contented with his booty.
Must be all the horse riding. Good for the buns.
With his booty, meaning his prize, that he let the nobleman, Lord Essex, pass without punishing him any further for his disloyalty to the crown. But he did say that if he was to meet him again, he desired a similar such sum. So with a nod and a wink, he was on his way. Ching, ching.
So Brown made a stain on Essex's reputation. So, Matt, tell me, what would the authorities be looking for in the highway robbery of a stagecoach?
Well, skid marks.
Well, people were scared, I suppose.
No. The coach on the wheels, Wayne. The coach on the wheels.
Oh yeah, of course. Anyway, another time, Lord Fairfax, who was also Chief General of the Parliamentarian Army after Essex was replaced during the war.
Well, actually, it's worth saying Fairfax is largely considered the best general in the parliamentary side, or perhaps any, during the Civil War.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, his home was based in the country of Northumberland, but at this time, he was based in Newcastle-upon-Tyne, at the same time that Howard chanced to be in the same town.
Mm-hmm.
And it came to Captain Zach's ear that Fairfax was about to send a man to his wife, Lady Fairfax, with some lovely silver plate.
A lovely bit of silver plate, but she'll be happy to receive that. So when the trusted messenger left with the silver plate and a letter from Fairfax, our highwayman, Captain Zach, also took leave of Newcastle and rode after the Roundhead servant.
The Roundheads, by the way, that was a nickname for those that fought for the Parliamentarian side. It was a name thrown at them by the Royalists as they wore their hair short and clipped.
Yeah.
Not hugely fashionable, didn't that great. And the long-haired Royalist rockers found it very amusing. They also wore a rounded helmet to go over the top of that too.
Yeah, to give them the full...
Hence Roundhead.
Well, exactly, yes. Thank you, Wayne. And it's good to... Well, we've got the Cavalier explained and we've got the Roundhead explained now. So, Zachary tailed the servant and then he overtook him on the road and fell into a deep discourse with him when he met him at a junction on the road a bit later on about some old bollocks. History does not record exactly what was said, but it does say that they struck up a friendship.
Or so the servant thought.
Yes. They then travelled together towards Berkshire. It's quoted as they baited, dined, supped and lay together.
Two guys.
Yeah, it's a bit weird, isn't it?
This sounds a bit overly friendly to me. I mean, supped, really?
Mm.
So it sounds... Is it Brown by name, Brown by nature here?
they continued in this very friendly manner till the messenger came within a day's journey of the Fairfax home.
Yeah, and next morning, being the last day they were to be together, Howard thought it was now high time to execute his cunning plan.
Yes.
Oh. Which he did. But it did not go smoothly.
Perhaps less cunning than he thought it was.
Well, it turns out that his plan was to distract his companion, tie him up.
I'm sure he's been doing a bit of that over the last few days.
Yeah, sounds like it. nick the silver, and then take that letter to Lady Fairfax himself.
So, Wayne, what went wrong?
Well, he was an idiot. Well, as they were riding along, Zachary pulled out his blunderbuss weapon and commanded the fellow to deliver the goods, which was, of course, that silver plate we were talking about earlier.
Yes, I remember.
Yeah, to the value of £250.
Ooh, ching ching.
Yeah. But the messenger, it seems, was no pushover, and being a resolute, brave sort of chap, refused to comply. You know, he's used to these dark roads. Probably quite a tough guy, isn't he?
Mm, yeah.
So, at this time, a sharp combat ensued between the two, in which Captain Zack had his horse shot from under him.
Bloody hell.
Yeah. After a discharge of all three pistols on either side.
Wow, all were spent.
All were spent. And the encounter was in the balance until Zack shot this poor guy through the head. And that, you know, kind of ended proceedings right there.
Well, that would do it. So,
yes, it would do it, Matt.
It would. Zack was a bit gutted, though, as he'd hoped not to have killed the chap, as he quite liked him. So when Howard saw the man dead, he thought, he'd best mate like an elephant's cock and hit the road.
Brilliant example.
Thank you.
So he nimbly
mounted his remaining horse, which carried the treasure, and he rode till he found a place to stash the loot. From there, he made the best way he could to Farringdon in Berkshire, which was the home of Madame Fairfax, and he duly delivered the letter in the evening, posing as a servant.
Well, he's got some balls, this guy, hasn't he?
And they were fully loaded, as we'll find out later.
Yes. The lady, learning by the contents of the letter that a parcel of plate was sent by the bearer, inquired of him where it was. And Zachary readily told her that he was in danger of being robbed of it on such a horrible dark heath by some suspicious persons. And so he left it with a trusted innkeeper with the intentions of getting it the next day.
On the morrow.
That's what they would say. This pleased the Lady Fairfax, and she allowed him to stay at the residence until morning. A bit silly, maybe?
Yeah, we'd won their confidence. So the whole family at that time consisted only of the lady, her daughter, two maids, and two men servants. No sooner were all these gone to sleep than Howard arose.
Got up.
Yeah.
He was up.
Dressed himself. With his sword and his pistol in hand, he went into the servants' apartments. All four he tied and gagged.
Oh, God.
Now, he's not a nice guy, this Zachary Howard, and I have to say he was less than respectable with Lady Fairfax.
He totally rogered her, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He did. I was hoping to disguise that with a hint, but yes, you're right. He
well,
did.
We're all adults here. The guy was a criminal.
Yeah. But after he secured the house, guys, okay, he basically robbed the house of all 2,000 pieces of gold and buggered off via his tree to get his plate, and he made off.
Via his tree? Okay, not a horse.
Well, you know, this is where he stashed his loot.
Oh, I see. Yeah, he certainly had some gumption about him, this guy, didn't he?
Yeah.
Anyway, so after this very highly publicised robbery and debasement of Lady Fairfax...
Yes.
Not surprisingly, a huge bounty was then placed on his head. So, like most criminals, he fled to Ireland, where he continued his former courses till being grown as a notorious there in Ireland, as well as he was back in England. He thought it's advisable, he was laid low for a while, probably time to return now.
Yeah. Now, you think to himself, well, I've got away with it, you know, so far, maybe I should stop. You know, I've robbed Essex, I've robbed Fairfax, essentially. Well, he has robbed him, and he's done more, to be honest. So he's taken the two, number three and number two
big
from
jobs.
The Parliament.
Two big jobs.
Yeah, he's done two big jobs, right? So you think he could retire, but no. He was missing someone, the number one.
Numero uno.
The top dog.
The head cheese.
That's right. Zachary was after none other than...
Charles I.
No, Charles I is dead. This is post-Civil War. Yeah. He was after Oliver Cromwell.
Oh, yeah, of course. Oh, yeah, of course. Right, yeah. Anyway, so he landed at Highlake on his return from Ireland and proceeded from there to the city of Chester.
All right.
Chester, Matt.
Yeah, sort of, you know,
at the same time that no other than that Lord Protector Cromwell himself was in town. With a party of men and bodyguards. Yeah, the laws of hangers-on. And we know enough about Zachary to know this would not put him off. You know, he really had an axe to grind with these guys. So a chance to get to stick one up the Parmentarians was too much for him to refuse.
So he passed himself off as a roundhead fanatic gentleman who was going essentially to go and travel as a history teacher. So he got himself into character and he hatched a plan to chat with Cromwell and win his confidence. He found out where Cromwell was drinking one evening and joined him there, splashing his cat.
Splashing his cat? Is that a euphemism for the withdrawal technique or something?
Jesus. Sorry, splashing his cash.
Yes.
And catching the eye of Cromwell in the bar, who was deep in conversation with a friend.
Well, you see, my lord, whatever your name is, you can't rush into things. Don't do a Prince Rupert and go and make a mess, then charge off to the baggage tents while your army gets cut to pieces. you see my Naseby joke, do you like it?
Quite so, it's very good, yeah.
No, we need to be much more thorough with the Irish.
God be praised on you, Cromwell.
Well, do I see another like me in this godforsaken inn? How do you, good sir?
Why, my lord protector, may I say I'm most honoured to meet you.
Yes, you may. You may say this.
Yes, can my eyes believe to see the man that freed this country from the tyranny of that beloved, of that blasted King Charles?
Yes. Sir, your praise to me should be to my master, the Lord God himself.
Yes.
Who saw fit to make this happen.
Did he?
With a little bit of help from me.
Yes, he did very well.
If indeed you must praise me, I'll have a pint of ale, good sir. The Lord's work is thirsty at times.
Of course you will, you king-slaying scum.
What?
Yes, of course, Lord Protector.
You're right, okay.
2 pints of flaming traitor. What? Off, isn't it? I mean, old badger's flange, please, barkeep.
Please. Call me Cromwell, good sir. And who is it I am addressing?
I'll call you a kingslayer and a murderer of God's precious subject on earth.
What?
No. I'm just a travelling historian. I'm most keen to see if you're so grateful, sir, that you tell me some of your... I know you're so active in there, some of your war stories.
Ah, some good old stories, are they? Be specific.
Well, I think for one, I was such a fan of your cowardly manoeuvres at Naseby. Clever manoeuvres at Naseby.
It's a great battle.
It was, yes. Yes, your men did very well. It could be said, sir, that you won that battle with your charge.
Yes. I've often been told that.
Why did you alone, you traitorous king? Yes. Well, please, sir, treat me to some history of your daring do.
Well, I'm not a man to talk about my heroic and selfless deeds in battle. Well, perhaps I maybe tell you just a one. I'm writing a book, you see. It's a little overview of the history of my life. What to call my story? I can see you wondering. Well, do you know, I kind of like the sound of English Finest Man, Oliver Cromwell. And I've put small letters at the bottom of the little joke at the bottom says, don't lose your head over this book. Ha, 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 you know.
Oh, it's a
king. No, it's just about the king. So you're maybe sitting there wondering, how does such a man like me come from very little to become a titan of a military leader, as I am today, to rival, as I'm told, Julius Caesar, Alexander the Great?
Yes.
Well, you see, my love of horses is the key. And of course, been in the cavalry. It all started when I was 5 years old, riding my sister's pony. Lovely creature called Happy Ending.
More ales for the egotistical knave. Great leader of men and myself.
Yes.
Please, barkeep. Please, carry on, Cromwell. I'm sure I will want to hear more of this story.
So Happy Ending was a playful mare.
Quite.
And enjoyed nothing more than a hard ride and a large carrot to scratch her at the end of an ear.
So as the night wore on, Cromwell drank more and the two men got on like a house on fire. The innkeep asked that he close the bar, and Cromwell, only halfway through his short story to Zachary, got up, invited Zachary up to his chambers for a nightcap and a continuation of the story.
Oh, hello. Yeah, and Cromwell was religiously devoted, of course. Mm-hmm. And before sending Zachary away, asked him if he wanted to take prayers with him. But no sooner was Cromwell down upon his knees
in front of Zachary,
yeah, then he knocked him down with the butt end of the pistol.
Jesus.
Yeah, presenting it afterwards, obviously barrel first, to his chest, and swearing that if he did not but attempt to make the least bit of noise, he would shoot him through the heart. Although he would be sure to be hanged for it.
Well, these terrifying words struck the Lord Protector with such a panic and fear that he permitted the assaulter to do what he pleased. Who thereupon gagged him and bound him hand and foot. After this, he rifled through a couple of trunks, and out of which he took about 1,100
trunks
coins.
Trunks are like chests, not like
trousers. Not like trousers. Yeah. He took about 1,100 coins. Then, taking a bedpan, which happened to be pretty well filled
with the warm fluids of a man.
Yes.
Horrible.
He clapped it on the head of Cromwell, soaking him, crowning him in such a manner as he deserved.
Cromwell must have been really pissed.
Yeah.
But
he was covered. Having finished what he designed, he hastily ran downstairs and mounted on his horse, which he had actually ordered to be ready for him under the pretense of some urgent business a few miles out of town.
Yes, now, by this means, he got clear away before Oliver, who fell to the floorboards and started banging as soon as he thought the enemy safely at distance and out of earshot. And then at last, several of the innkeep's family went upstairs and were guided by their noses to where the poor leader sat, shaken, miserable, and soaked in urine.
Wow. Sounds like a good night out for you, Wayne.
Every Friday, if I don't end up soaked in urine, it's not a good night.
What, because you're not drunk enough?
No, I'm teetotal.
What? Oh.
As soon as Cromwell was freed and well wiped down, he fell upon his knees again to give thanks for deliverance from the fury of a wicked man and swore vengeance, Matt.
So a week later, Cromwell received a letter from Zachary wishing him well and making mirth of the state that he'd left him in, and said it was to remind him that no man was untouchable.
Like it.
Perhaps Zachary should have read his own letter, though.
Because shortly after this exploit, in a fit of overconfidence, Zach attacked a dozen Republican officers together as they were riding across Blackheath. And unsurprisingly, he was actually overpowered by their number, and though he vigorously defended himself so as to kill one and wound two more of them.
He beat a few guys off.
He did beat a few off, but there were still nine left, and that was too many for him, Matt. He was at last taken by the remaining three.
Taken by three men, yeah.
Now, these were soon assisted by several passengers as well, you know, sort of like came by. They came as well and joined in, carrying this bold robber before a magistrate, who forthwith committed him to Maidstone Jail in Kent.
Oliver Cromwell, sensing a chance to address matters, went to see him there and insulted him with a great many reproaches. Ha ha ha, you're the one covered in urine now. Or something along those lines.
It's pretty good, yeah.
To all which Howard replied with his usual bravery and wit, to the utter confusion and annoyance of Cromwell.
His trial was quick and decisive, Matt, and he was sentenced to be hanged until dead. It's a sentence of death. When he came to the place of execution, he appeared all in white. He confessed himself guilty of everything he stood charged with, but declared he was sorry for nothing but the murders he'd committed.
Yet even these, he said, it appeared to him less criminal when he considered the persons to whom they were acted upon. He professed further that if he were pardoned and at liberty again, he would never leave off robbing the roundheads, so long as there were any of them left in England alive.
So he was bold, cocksure, and committed until the end, and really hated parliamentarians.
Yeah.
And what was most remarkable at Howard's death was his smiling at Oliver Cromwell, who came into the country on purpose to see the last of him, with an air of scorn and contempt. So he ended his life in 1652, being just 32 years of age, Matt.
Yeah, a young man. Mm. So Zachary was a brave soul. But moving on from him now, one guy I really liked the sound of, and sounds like he may have had a lot to do with the gallantry of Hiraman, was Captain James Hind.
You like the sound of Hind?
Yes. He was another post-Civil War 17th century Hiraman. He came from very working class roots, though, so he wasn't like Zachary, not from royalty, or not a noble. But he wanted to better himself, but not in a legal way.
That's criminals for you.
Yes, indeed. So he made contact with members of the criminal underworld, and he became part of the Allen Gang,
ooh,
led by Thomas Allen, after all.
It's pretty imaginative naming.
The Allen Gang, yeah. To join them, they tested him out and asked him to rob the first traveller he met.
First traveller he met. And while he was doing that, the gang hid in nearby bushes, as you might expect.
Mm-hmm.
And Hind did as he was told and robbed some poor chap. The first one he saw. But
yeah,
then he stopped.
Oh, what happened?
Well, he noticed the despair on the face of the victim and actually gave some money back to him.
A highwayman with a heart.
A highwayman with a heart. And the gang saw this and asked him about it. And he said the man had nothing. He was destitute. Allen, remember the gang's leader, there were fearless highwaymen himself, like this, and actually liked Hind's integrity.
Yeah.
Thought that maybe the guy could be trusted.
So he was a highwayman before the war. Then he fought for Charles I during the war. When the king was executed in 1649, Hind went back to being a highwayman and the highwayman life with Allen. But now the motive to continue the war was against Cromwell, and it was an unofficial war.
Yeah, like a one-man army against impossible odds, blah, 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 that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, maybe. They resolved to ambush Cromwell and his party outside Huntingdon. But the plan went tits up.
Ooh.
Allen was captured, but Hind escaped, and literally he rode his horse to death, escaping.
What a great guy! Unless you like horses, like Cromwell appeared to.
Yes.
Shortly afterwards, he held up a church clergyman, looked on very unfavourably at the time, obviously, who, when facing Hind, harangued Hind about the dire verbal warnings about what the Almighty would do to those who infringed on the Eighth Commandment. You know what that is, Matt?
No.
We quote again from our resident historian, Professor Harrington.
The minister says to Hind,
Professor, Your Honor,
it is written in it's a law, isn't it? It's written in the law that thou shalt not.
Quicker, please, Professor, quicker.
Thou shalt not steal. And furthermore,
spit out quicker.
Solomon. Solomon, who was surely a very wise, he was, speaketh in this manner. Rob.
Oh, hurry up, for God's sake, you see how old.
Rob not the poor, because he is poor.
Well done, Professor.
Yes.
Now take your medicine.
Yes. Hold on, get away from me!
The prattling clergyman concluded, and he expected Hind to back down. But actually was countered by Hind, who responded with a series of biblical quotes about the ungodliness of man, how the virtues of humility and charity expounded by Jesus contrasted with the practices and the hierarchy of the church.
Well, amen to that.
Yes, indeed. The cleric was quickly reduced to a thoughtful silence, and he duly handed over his coinage.
Yeah, very persuasive. Hind has often been celebrated for his generosity to all sorts of people, more specifically for his kindness to the poor from whence he came, which is reported was so extraordinary for a criminal and a highwayman. And he never injured or killed any person who had not a complete share of riches. So he was a bit of a Robin Hood character, you know, basically robbed from the rich, gave to the poor, although I suspect it wasn't that much he did actually give to the poor. Although at one time, when he was out of cash...
As he frequently was, by reason of extravagance and party-like lifestyle...
Yeah, he spied an old man jogging along the road. That's right, Matt. In those days, people still jogged.
Very good.
He rode up to meet him and asked him courteously, "Hey there, old man, where are you off to?"
"Who, me? To the market in Wantage, to buy me an ass, that I may have it for my children."
"Well, if you want to buy some ass, you're probably best off turning around and going back to the village. So, what's an ass, you say?"
"You know, like a donkey. Ass, yes. Good sir, for my children."
"Yes, of course. How many children may you have, old wizened one?"
"10. Come from the loins of mine."
"Jesus. I mean, so how much money do you have on you, wrinkly-faced one?"
Well, I have about 40 shillings, master. I've been saving it for 2 years. So I have, yes, I have. Oh, yes. So I have. Yes, 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 indeed.
Yes. Okay. Oh, yes. Say yes a lot,
yes,
don't you?
Yes, yes.
Are you nervous?
Yes.
Well, now then, my thoughts go out to you, O arthritic one. Look, the money you have got about you, I must have at this time. I hope you don't mind, but I will not wrong your children of their ass. My name is Hind, and if you'll give me your 40 shillings quietly...
Yes, I will.
Yes, and meet me again at this day 7 nights hence.
Oh.
At this place.
Yes.
I promise to make the sum double. You can do that sum, presumably.
Well, yes, yeah, I can do that.
80 shillings. Only be cautious.
50, yes.
That you never mention a word of the matter to anybody between this and that.
Well, it seems a fantastic deal. Aye.
At the day appointed, the old man came. Hind was as good as his word, bidding him buy 2 cows instead of just the 1 ass, and adding 20 shillings to the sum promised, that he might purchase the best in the market.
I'd probably prefer the ass, but never was highwayman more careful than Hind to avoid bloodshed.
Yes.
And when finally caught during the Protectorate...
That's the period of time from the end of the Civil War to the restoration of King Charles II, a period when Oliver Cromwell was known as the Lord Protector. Carry on.
Oh, okay, thank you. Hind was charged with treason rather than highway robbery because of his expressed royalist loyalty. And what happened to him?
Well, he was hung, drawn and quartered in 1652 at Worcester.
Oh, God. Well, the barbarous act of being hung, drawn and quartered is pretty horrible, and most highwaymen were hung. But due to Hind's political affiliation, of course, they had to make an example of him.
Poor chap. When he found out, he must have been in bits.
Yeah, I mean, he was all over the place.
So, with the death of Hind, that concludes the coverage of the post-Civil War highwaymen.
Well, of course, there were many highwaymen that we haven't looked at before and after the Civil War.
Yeah.
But we have to do one at some point. Yeah, so what's the second part here?
It would have been the longest podcast ever. Yeah. The second part will feature highwaymen after the restoration of the monarchy. So that's Charles II coming to the throne of England again. We will cover my favourite highwayman in this section, a certain Claude Duval.
Oh.
Indeed. And of course, we'll talk around the mythology of a certain Dick Turpin. And what eventually caused the end of the highwayman robberies.
Yeah, so we've featured the highwayman of post-English Civil War period so far. But in 1660, after the death of Oliver Cromwell, feeling that having a king back on the throne...
Albeit with less powers than Charles I and past kings had.
Yeah, it was a very attractive idea. After all, Matt, it's better the tyrannical, megalomaniac, handily godly appointed insane ruler that you know...
than a power-grabbing psychopath that is, importantly, not appointed by God.
Yeah. must be appointed by God. So with Puritan England now missing a head of state soon after Cromwell's death, Charles II was then crowned the King of England. And of course, this period was known as, with the King coming back, the Restoration.
So in relevance to the podcast and the Highwayman, it was now not just the pro-parliamentarians that were on the dinner menu for the Highwayman and the footpads. Also, there were it was going to be the royalists as well.
For dessert.
In fact, pretty much everybody was on the dinner menu now.
A sort of a smorgasbord.
A smorgasbord.
Yeah.
And shortly after the Restoration, rumours started to come in of a French highwayman robbing the ladies on Hounslow Heath, who was a rather dashing and charming gentleman.
Yes, yeah, so he sort of took him from behind, didn't he? Well, what I mean by that is that they sort of approach a carriage from behind, but you can't see them, surprise the driver, and, you know, put them over, and your robbery can then commence, Matt, from that point onwards.
Oui, oui.
Yeah. So his name was Claude Duval. As you may have gathered from that name, he's French. I'm surprised I couldn't smell him coming. And he was indeed a gallant and courteous rogue. Probably the most dashing highwayman ever to haught or mince upon the English highways. He was known as a true gentleman of the road. That's what they called him, Matt. And an eternal feather in the cap of highway gentility.
Wow, this guy sounds great.
Yeah, well, it suggests that he certainly sounds like a gentleman.
Oh, yes.
That's how he wanted to come off.
He's good PR.
When he's robbing these ladies.
Definitely.
In fact, it was said of Duval, he was French, he was flash, and his pockets were full of cash.
Well, probably 300 years after the death, when that term cash was used.
Yeah, but I like that, and so I thought we should shoehorn this into the podcast. You know.
Well, you know, I just like to describe him as a Frenchman who, coming to England,
very descriptive,
became...
Very descriptive.
By his politeness and gallantry on the road... The romantic darling of the ladies, executed 21st of January, 1670.
Yeah. Brackets, probably a rapist. Now, that sounds like you have directly lifted that quote from the source, Matt, is it?
No way, Wayne. That's exactly how I speak, honestly.
Right, so it's just your own little romantic thing you've come up with.
So let's learn more about this French gent.
Okay, so who was this guy then? Well, they say he was born a humble miller's son in Normandy, who, when he was 13... fell in with a group of English royalists on their way to Paris. Obviously, they were on the run, escaping retribution after the end of the Civil War.
Well, it would have been difficult not to be. In the 50s, there were more exiled royalists in France than fleas on a dog.
So they had a lot of royalists.
England, you see, held nothing for them. They had lost the war, and under Cromwell, music, dancing, theatres, inns, whoring, flamboyant clothing, Wayne, you know a lot about that,
yes.
Christmas and laughing on a Sunday, had all been banned.
Yes, I do. Well, I just like colour, Matt.
The hiss.
So how did these Puritans relax then? That was a rhetorical question, Matt. Don't answer that. I'll do it. Those of a Puritan persuasion enjoy devoting their free time to pious worship and penitence to the Lord.
Rock and roll.
To their Lord. But every godless debauchee with an appetite for sin and a large enough purse immediately sailed across the channel and started calling himself Monsieur.
Many of them lodged in Faubourg Saint-Germain.
It's the Faubourg Saint-Germain.
Is it?
Germain.
Is it?
Germain. It's on the coast.
It's somewhere in France.
Yeah.
And the young Claude became an errand boy there at a tavern. Come cookshop, come brothel. Watching these well-to-do fools spend a fortune on wine, women and amateur dramatics, he scampered about filling their glasses and polishing their boots.
Is that a euphemism?
But no doubt gave rise to impertinent thoughts of bettering his own station. Why can't I do this for myself one day? Allez?
That's very good. So, when, to the despair of the righteous Puritans and the unbridled joy of the Royalists, Charles II returned as king in 1660, all of his followers came home to Matt. Many brought French footmen to attend them, as this was a very fashionable affectation at the time, actually, as it was thought that the rudeness and hauteur of their demeanour reflected well upon their master's breeding.
Well, their masters in Paris today must be incredibly well bred.
You wouldn't think it to look at them.
It was the sign of the times that these exotic French imports were particularly popular among, you know, wanton married women who found the simple affections of their English husbands were deemed as unromantic.
I can't imagine that really, Matt. Us Englishmen deemed as unromantic.
Well, what do you like to do with your lady, for example?
We just like to watch, put the spot there a little bit, but we just like to watch like sport and sci-fi films, that sort of stuff. I mean, she's not normally in the room. Anyway, she's normally out, doing cooking or ironing or whatever, so I don't know, really. Anyway, carry on.
Well, exactly. Totally romantic, us Englishmen. You couldn't move in the 60s, the 1660s, without being with some insipid gallant sniffing around your wife.
Oof. So Claude came to England in the employ of Charles the Stuart, the third Duke of Richmond. By then, he was well-versed in gentlemanly manners. He could ride a horse, for example. he could shoot a pistol straight. And he would appreciate the value of gold, of course.
Ching, ching. Sorry.
Like any would. And like many in his profession, he was well-trained. He was a tough guy. He was a highwayman in waiting.
In fact, it was said that he was already rummaging beneath the skirts of his employer's bride-to-be, a lady called Frances Stuart. She was apparently a real looker for the time.
What, you mean, presumably that sort of thin and pale? Yeah, thin and pale and sad-looking. That's what they all seemed to look like in the pictures at the time.
Well, perhaps then that explains why Claude left the Duke's service. Before he was horse-whipped, and he took to the road.
Yeah, so the universal joy upon the return of the royal family made the whole nation almost mad with joy.
Mad.
It's not that sort of mad. Sorry, they were just happy, basically.
Yeah, it's a different kind of mad.
So everyone ran into extravagances, and Duval, whose inclinations were as vicious as any man's, soon became an extraordinarily proficient guy at gaming, whoring, Matt, drunkenness, Matt, and all manner of debauchery. And of course, as you might expect, the natural effect of these courses is to run out of money, isn't it, Matt, to fund a lifestyle like this. And this he experienced in a very short time, and he could not think of labouring, construction, stuff like that. So he took to the highway to support his debauched appetites.
Or perhaps addictions.
Well, they were addictions, yes.
Two stories are well known about Claude. The most famous being Claude stopped a stagecoach with a gentleman.
Freudian slip there.
And a lady inside this coach. As Claude rode his horse to the window, he stated in his French accent, "Monsieur, your money or your wife?"
"Oh, good Lord."
"Yes, you may gasp as I come upon you. But it is your lucky day, for I am he. Yes, I am Claude Duval.
God.
English highwayman. And I accost you in my outrageous accent."
"Sir, I heard of you. Yes, and your exploits. God. Sir, please take my money and don't hurt me. Us there, yes. Okay, dear. There is £400. This is all we have, sir. Okay. Please do not hurt me. And, right, I'm telling him. Or my young, attractive, impressionable and big-breasted, fertile wife."
"Ah, good monsieur. You feel the pleasure in knowing I would treasure spending your £400 on the finest things made by a woman." "Oh! What is that sound? Madame, you play with your lips along that wooden flute shaft as though you were made by God to do such a thing."
"Thank you.
Your shaft work is magnifique. I am erected at your flute work. Damn you, heavenly creature. I'm elated by your music. You enchant me. I should have been seen you burnt at the stake, for you have bewitched moi."
"Why, sir, thank you. I'm pleased to have pleased you so very well. The ladies in court, actually, well, they often talk about a certain French highwayman strutting around the heath. Yes. I feel it's my luck to have been found by your garlicness. Gallicness.
"Your music has aroused me, madame. I cannot help it. I feel something hard in my breeches that I must release, and I am obliged, madame, to get it out and to show you."
"What, sir? What are you going to show me?"
Mufflet, madame. Now I will play for you, because you have played for me. And you must dance, my darling. Dance for me.
Yay!
So as Claude played, the lady joined in. So he and the lady played their flutes in an impromptu 17th century jam. The lady got down from the coach, and with Claude's help, she began to dance. Claude played on and danced the dance called the Coranto.
Beautiful was, dance, that.
Yeah, it's a popular dance of the day. Now, our resident historian, Professor Harrington, quotes...
It was surprising, yes, very surprising, to see how graceful he... was it he, wasn't it?
Yes, it's he.
He moved upon the grass, that man, yes. Scarce a dancing master in London. In London, but would have been proud, yes. Proud. Proud man, wasn't he? Proud to have shown such agility in a pair of pumps as Duval, French, wasn't he? French.
Yes.
It's Duval, fellow.
Yes, he is French.
Claude's name, wasn't it?
Yes, Claude.
Claude Duval showed in a pair of riding boots, probably, wasn't he? He's wearing when he's dancing with riding boots.
I can't take your medicine.
Get away from me!
So at the end of this dance, they put their flutes away, and Claude escorted the lady back to the coach. Then handed her back, Matt, the £400. What a gentleman.
Madame, I return these £400 to you. I cannot bear to take it from such a beauty as you.
Stop it.
Your flaggette in your lips has robbed me. Darling, it is you who has robbed me.
My dear Miss Duval, I've not robbed you. You're the one to rob us.
No, madame, you are wrong, for you have robbed me of my most precious possession. Something I guard from ever being taken. My French beating heart. It is yours for now. Just for you. You heart thief.
Oh, Monsieur Duval. You mean this? I came with you now. Leave my husband here. And live a life with you on the road. Oh, yes. I like that. I'm yours for all the ways.
Diana, excuse me, I'm sitting next to you. What about me? I've had to wash this whole bloody thing. Why don't you ever do that to me? I didn't even know you played the bloody flute.
Yes, she plays the flute. And I notice you did not get to see me play with your wife and dance with her, but you have not paid a thing for such a privilege.
What? You're kidding, right?
No,
what do you mean?
I'm not kidding. I charge you £100 for witnessing such a splendor and performance. Now cough it up, you tart English geared.
It's a fair cup. Here. Now, be off with you, sir.
Write to me, Duval. Write to me.
Diana, you don't really love him, do you? I mean, you were just saying, weren't you? Please say you were.
Of course, my love. You are the keeper of my heart.
Then Duval got on his horse, spoke to his fellow highwayman lurking in the shadows, who had kept the drivers under the musket the whole time.
Goodbye, dear Diana.
Right, Harold, let's go into town, get pissed on some cheap wine, and the first prostitute's on me. Wallop!
Right you go, Abner. Monsieur. And off he galloped, £100 the richer.
But, Wayne, not all the stories are so charming about Duval. He once held up a lady who had a baby, and the baby was suckling on a silver dummy. Now Duval robbed them and took the dummy, and the baby did what babies do.
That's horrible. Cried.
Cried. It cried loudly. And Duval on his horse, beginning to ride away, He felt guilty and returned the dummy to the grief-stricken mother.
Okay, well, it's still his charming that did win through in the end of that particular occasion.
Well, that's true. He's not like Dick Turpin, who would have just run off.
He probably would have done.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the London Gazette described him as the most wanted highwayman in England. So, obviously, the authorities didn't think it was particularly charming.
Well, I bet the ladies in the court wanted him for different reasons.
Well, they may have done. The authorities, he evaded capture for over 7 years with. I'm not sure if that's quite the same case with those ladies.
Mm-hmm.
And then, at Christmas, he was finally caught. And Duval in a prison cell. It's not one you see in the song today, but that's what happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
He was caught, apparently. He was reeling drunk and full of festive cheer, be it mulled wine or whatever else.
Mm-hmm.
Very drunk in those days at Christmas. He was captured at a place called Mother Matherby's Tavern in Chandler Street. You know it?
No, I don't actually.
Well, that's where he was caught. And then
I wonder if it's still around.
Probably not, actually. And then he was sent to Newgate Prison, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens there? You get tried. You get judged. You get sentenced. In this case, it was Judge Sir William Morton, and the sentence wasn't going to be a good one, was it?
Well, a lot of effort went in, though, despite frantic efforts of the ladies of the court and even King Charles II.
Yeah. Well, he was a fan, wasn't he, of Duval, King Charles?
The judge refused to change the sentence of death. The king wished to give a reprieve, but the judge was adamant, and he backed up his adamancy about this by threatening to resign. And he was the prominent judge in England, and so the king gave way. Duval was hanged at the Tyburn on the 21st of January, 1670.
Au revoir!
Oh. He faced his end bravely, though. His hanging at Tyburn was the scene of much loud lamentation from a sympathetic crowd in attendance, which included several ladies wearing quality masks.
A mask? A bit weird, but I suppose they didn't want to be recognised, didn't they? Yeah. Well, it is said that scores of women had visited his cell to offer comfort, in inverted commas. So they'd wear masks and they did that, obviously, to hide their eyes, which are red-rimmed from sobbing, not to mention their faces from their husbands or whatever other onlookers you have there. But let's face it, it was likely more practical they did this so people who knew them couldn't recount their visits.
Oh, that's very, very true, yes.
Yeah. Now, after he was hung, his body was cut down and taken to Tangler Tavern in St Giles for a lying in state before a grand funeral at St Paul's. So this is obviously the celebrity at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he is said to have been buried beneath the central aisle with the following epitaph. Can you read this for me, Matt?
Yes. Here lies Duval. Reader, if male thy art, look for thy pass. If female, to thy heart. Much havoc has been made of both for all. Men he made stand, and women he made fall.
Made fall to their knees. So we can't escape it any longer. We have to talk about Big Dick. Here he comes, Matt.
Yes.
Mr. T.
And
Turpin.
Dick Turpin, yes. And do you know he was not the only Dick that was on the highway?
Indeed. There was a famous Galloping Dick too, which is a bit of a weird name. I suppose he had a horse. But let's just talk about Turpin, albeit fairly briefly.
Okay, so it will be brief. This is already quite a long podcast, and Dick Turpin, the man versus the myth, is an interesting area when you're talking about him. Because the myth is actually, in this case, much greater than the man.
I think if you asked anyone, if you said, name a highwayman,
say Dick Turpin.
They'd come out and say Dick Turpin.
Yeah,
so he's probably the most remembered highwayman.
So Dick Turpin is, as you say, the best remembered. Although he was often found to be in North London, Essex and Yorkshire, Turpin was actually born in Hempstead in Essex in 1706. And he was finally imprisoned in York and was later hanged and buried in 1739.
Okay, so still quite young, I guess.
Yeah.
Although a lot of what we know about Dick Turpin is based around a bit of artistic license here, perhaps, based around a book that was published and very popular at the time and had a character in it, unsurprisingly, that was referenced as Dick Turpin. And supposedly this chap was debonair, charming, daring, sexy.
Oh.
In short, the view we have of Turpin today, and the view that many of the people at the time had of that sort of romantic, chivalrous highwayman.
Yeah, and the truth, though, is the author created this character from the exploits of a number of highwaymen, and put them into one character called Dick Turpin. Now, Claude Duval can be seen as one of the characters. Also, Wayne?
Well, we've got there's plenty, actually, that we could go through, but time constraints mean that we can't. Like, there's John Neveson, for example.
He was definitely one in the created, wasn't he?
Yeah, Neveson, he was like a fantastic highwayman, so please read up on him if you get time. But one of Turpin's famous myths is that he rode from London to York in one night.
Sounds almost impossible.
It does sound impossible. It does sound like the sort of thing you just write down in a book. That was actually now believed to be John Neveson anyway, and not Turpin after all. Even if it did happen, that's a long way to go on a horse.
So the book was called Rookwood, and if you want to, you know, want a good read, it's a seminal book when you think of the creation of the myth of the highwayman and Turpin. But like many books, it was a work of fiction.
Yeah. So in the unlikely event that you do need more information on highwaymen after listening to this podcast...
And you probably have more than you ever, ever wanted or needed already.
Give that a little read. And Turpin, in reality, is not really that special of a highwayman. I don't know whether it was the name fitted or it was the right time or, you know, he was just in the news at the time. He was, by all accounts, basically a thug.
Mm-hmm.
A criminal. Yep. Initially into thieving and some pretty unpleasant house raids with local group of thugs called the Gregory Gang, wasn't it?
Gregory Gang, yeah.
Yeah, so they would have been a violent...
They were pretty violent and, yeah, not very nice and did house raids and nasty stuff happened to the people they did house raids with. And...
Well, eventually those guys, they were all caught and killed anyway. So he thought, I'm going to go it alone. Highway robberies seems to be an affluent way of getting yourself a bit of cash right now.
So... You know, in summary of Dick Turpin, he's, you know, he was a great highwayman, but he isn't necessarily, you know, the debonair guy that we all think about. He was a highwayman, but when we looked through, looking at this, when we got past the myth, there was nothing really exceptional about him that we wanted to talk about.
Or if I was going to maybe put those eloquent words I've mapped there into one sentence, I'd probably say the guy... was just a criminal. So to conclude this review of the highwayman, we need to finally discuss how did they come to an end, Matt?
Now, Wayne, when I say the Bow Street Runners, does that mean anything to you?
Bow Street Runners. Yes, of course. That is the North Carolina-based psychedelic rock group, isn't it? Who released one eponymous album, I think, in limited quantities.
Well, yes and no. No.
No.
These guys helped to bring down the highwayman, Wayne.
Oh, right.
Not sell records to a limited but loyal fan base in the 1970s.
Really? Well, I must really know more about these Bow Street Runners which you speak, Matt. Please continue.
Well, to set the scene, let's look at the reasons why highwaymen died out. Now, towards the end of the 18th century, an accumulation of factors led to the fall of the numbers of highwaymen on English roads.
Yeah.
Many reasons accounted for this. The influence of a reward systems to grass up the suspected highwayman.
Yeah.
Better roads that allowed the stagecoaches to travel faster at greater speeds. Turnpikes. Yeah. Now, a turnpike...
That was at the end of the length of the road, wasn't it? And that sort of divided the road into sections, chunks, signposted, and the addition of a toll house, generally, where there'd be... I suppose that'd be manned as well, and they have to be supported, so there'd be less wild roads to travel, I suppose.
Absolutely, less opportunity.
Yeah, and I think also there was armed guards on mail coaches that added, of course, to the danger for highwaymen, made it far less attractive. A significant role was played during the reign of George III, from the 1760s to the 1790s, by the widespread practice of land enclosure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically, you know, men clearing ancient woodlands to create land for improved grassland farming. So, less places to hide and leap out at people, Matt.
Yes, absolutely.
And anyway, in those places, you'd have stock as well that could be safely grazed. There'd be fences there as well. That's when you see the landscape start to be divided into sort of like hedgerows to keep the animals enclosed and so on.
Yeah.
Much harder to squirrel yourself away and leap out.
Yeah, and the various fences used for the purpose included posts, rails... Oxes and double oxes.
What the heck is an oxer? Is that, hang on, don't tell me. Is an oxer sort of like, I'm just going to guess here, a laid hedge with a ditch on one or both sides with an oak rail to protect it Something like that, is it?
It is. It makes it incredibly...
Wow.
It's amazing that you knew that.
Well, why is it important, though?
Well, it makes it incredibly difficult for a highwayman to get over that. If there's a ditch either side of a hedge, it's almost sort of denying them access,
risky.
Really. Yeah. So the fencing denied the highwayman vast open landscapes across which he had previously escaped.
Clapped off, yeah.
The getaway for a highwayman now was a tricky business unless he was able to jump a huge natural barrier.
Well, you don't want to do that when you're trying to get away. You break your leg of your horse or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, the risk to the highwayman was also increased by the larger number of horse-drawn vehicles on the road.
Yes.
He could easily be trapped with no obvious escape route while committing his robbery. So you've got to be careful. You could have the sudden appearance of another vehicle or rider on the scene of a crime. Not the sort of surprise you want. In that situation.
And another reason for the decline of the highwayman was the growing reluctance of the magistrates to grant licences to inns, which were known to be regular haunts for the highwayman. So a lot of the inns were used as resting places for the highwayman and places to get a tip-off.
Yeah.
And of course, we know if you hit them in their wallet book, then they're going to listen.
I think that's what it was called in those days, when they get the money in the wallet book.
What are they called?
Anyway, the gradual establishment...
Pocketbook!
Well, you're just guessing again, it sounds like, speculating. But the gradual establishment of the banking system as well, don't forget, in the 18th century, also helped to clear the road to highwaymen. Because at first, banks were restricted to London, initially. But later, they spread out to the provinces and other towns and cities. And consequently, by the end of the century...
Checks
and banknotes were habitually carried instead of all that beautiful gold and silver.
Absolutely. So... The final nail in the highwayman's coffin was the establishment of the Bow Street Runners, of which we started this section on. England's embryonic police force established by the Fielding brothers, the first serious suggestion for overcoming the grave deficiency in the system of law and order, was kicked off in 1749.
2 years later, when senior magistrate at Bow Street wrote his note into the causes of the late increase in highway robbery... He concluded that the principal causes of the increase in the crime rate, including highway robbery, were gambling, cheap gin, Matt.
Oh, mother's ruin.
Yeah. And the increase in what's perceived as luxury goods among the lower orders of the people.
Well, we can't be having the commoners having plush goods, can we? Got to keep the plebs in their place.
That's right. That's how they thought. And he recommended two main remedies as a result to improve the justice system as he saw it. There was the recruitment of a special police force at Bow Street, Matt, magistrate's office, and the offer of £100 rewards for the capture of highwaymen and other criminals.
So what happened in the past? Well, when a traveller was robbed, he went to the nearest turnpike gate to inform the toll house keeper. Previously, all the keeper could do was to shout a warning through a speaking trumpet that a highwayman was in the suspected vicinity.
Right, so... Now, what he's able to do is not just simply shout into a trumpet, but he can raise the alarm and bring out the Bow Street Runners in the area to give immediate pursuit. Rewards are also on offer to members of the public, too, to assist the Bow Street Runners, and cooperation was especially sought from those most likely to cross Highwayman's path, such as innkeepers, stable owners, blacksmiths, that sort of thing.
Yeah. The establishment of an effective, well-administered police force... Enjoying the support of the law-abiding section of the community made it extremely difficult for the highwaymen and outlaws to operate and eventually removed their menace.
Yeah, it makes it really hard for them. And in the initial stages, actually, the special police force at Bow Street consisted of just 6 or 7 thief-takers, as they were called.
And the thief-takers who patrolled the streets were subsequently named the Bow Street Runners.
Tough lads, though.
And they were supported by the increased government money. So a timeline of how this progressed was...
Well, firstly, in 1763... You had the establishment of an experimental nightly horse patrol of 8 men to protect travellers on the roads around London against the highwaymen.
In 1780, 6 more officers similar to Bow Street were opened.
Yeah, and then as far as 1792, in addition, another magistrate, Patrick Calhoun, I think it's pronounced, set up the Thames or Marine Force, a further step in the direction of an organised police force. They're really putting these guys off.
Yeah. And soon there was a force of 50 to 60 men at the Bow Street police headquarters. The Bow Street Runners then became official, and a uniformed horse patrol was formed to protect the principal roads within a 20-mile radius of London. The main objective was to clear notorious spots such as Hounslow Heath, of highwaymen so that travellers could undertake journeys with less trepidation. The police action met with huge success.
The first time, I suppose, that you got the concept of the police, or men of the police, city, are there to protect and serve the public. Don't forget mm-hmm. that, policemen.
Mm-hmm.
And the success of the Bow Street Runners in suppressing the menace of the highwaymen encouraged Sir Robert Peel, who was then the Home Secretary, to recruit greater numbers of these uniformed policemen. In London in 1822, they became known as Bobbies, as we all know, of course.
After his
first name, yeah.
Hence, Bobby on the beat.
Bobby on the beat. And Robert Bobby Peel was yes. Home Secretary, yeah.
In 1829, the Metropolitan Police Act was passed, which brought all the separate London forces under a central control, and a result was the establishment of the Metropolitan Police Force.
Which we still have today. So I don't know how we managed to do this, but we managed to shoehorn the formation of the Met Police into the podcast. They're going to be happy with that.
So on that bombshell, we conclude the podcast on the highwayman. We hope you enjoyed it. If you want to get in touch with us, we are now on Twitter.
Yeah, that is Historical Pod, or HistoricalPod.
Historical Pod. Please send us a Twitter. We'd like to hear from you. Or a tweet.
You can, tell we,
you can see how natural we are with yes. it, that I got it that wrong. So, Wayne, do you have anything to say and conclude before we sign off?
Yes, I do. I'll look forward to speaking to everyone in the next episode.
Bye.